From Rotary Magazine, this is the Rotary Voices podcast. I'm Steve Edwards. February marks the two-year anniversary of the war in Ukraine. Since the war began, Ukraine has recaptured over half the territory Russia once occupied. But Russia still holds power in 18% of the country. And so the war rages on, with over 10 million people displaced, nearly 22,000 civilian casualties, and 500,000 military casualties. As global leaders consider the path forward, UN officials worry that humanitarian assistance will slow, failing to meet the needs of Ukrainian refugees. At latest count, 17.6 million people are in need of such assistance. In light of this anniversary, we are bringing back an episode from this time last year. At the time, we investigated the situation in Ukraine, explored the prospect of peace, and discussed the importance of civil society in Ukraine's post-war rebuilding. In this episode, you'll hear from award-winning Ukrainian novelist Andrei Kurkov. He had just arrived in London after spending most of 2021 in Ukraine. There, he documented the resilience of ordinary Ukrainians in the face of unimaginable suffering. Later, we'll hear from Boris Bodnar. He's a Rotary member in Ukraine's western city of Lviv. Bodnar shared a detailed account of how the global Rotary network enabled swift humanitarian relief. But first, we spoke with John Huko about how growing up as a Ukrainian-American shaped his life and how his experience living and working in Russia and Ukraine has informed his views of what's happening there now. John Huko is the General Secretary and Chief Executive Officer of Rotary International and the Rotary Foundation. Earlier in his career, he was an international partner with the law firm of Baker & McKenzie, where he served as managing partner of its offices in Kyiv and Prague, and advised on the initial draft of the Ukrainian Constitution in 1991. John, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us. You know, it's interesting, in your speeches and interviews, you frequently talk about your father, Lou Huko, who fled Ukraine during World War II. I'm curious, how did your father's story shape your own identity as well as your perceptions of Ukraine?
Well, Steve, thank you so much for that question. My parents are from Western Ukraine, part of Poland prior to the Second World War, between the First and Second World War. And then in 1943, as the Soviet Army started moving west, pretty much everyone, Western Ukraine was very, very anti-communist. Certainly all the intelligentsia and people who were anti-communist fled. And that included my grandparents and my parents. And so they fled west. They weren't married at the time. They wound up meeting later in Detroit in the United States. But they fled west. And when the war ended, they were in southern Germany. And then I spent 4 years in what were called displaced persons camps. My father was in a camp near Mittenwald, south of Munich. And then in 1949, they were fortunate enough to be able to come to the United States. And their life had a tremendous impact on me and on my siblings. Whenever you're a child of political refugees, and that's what they were, that obviously influences what you hear, the stories you hear. My childhood and that of my siblings was, you know, stories of the war and fleeing and losing everything, coming to a new country with nothing, literally nothing, having to start from scratch, learning language. And so all that, I think, certainly gave me a real appreciation for, in my view, the horrors of communism and the communist system, and also imbued in me a real passion for Ukraine and its culture, because in the Soviet Union, there was an attempt to consciously stamp out Ukrainian language and culture. And so the Ukrainians in the diaspora, especially those that came to the United States after the Second World War, they in many ways felt we are the guardians of language and culture. And so I grew up speaking Ukrainian at home, with Ukrainian Saturday school, etc. So for me, it gave me a unique sense of Ukraine, its history, but also a great appreciation for the country that accepted them with such open arms and gave them and me and our families such opportunity.
Along the way, your father also became a Rotarian. Why did your father join Rotary?
My father personally was involved in many civic organizations, but particularly he really enjoyed his Rotary experience. He was a Rotarian for over 30 years. And when Ukraine became independent, his club in Clarkston, Michigan, was one of six clubs that sponsored the creation of the first Rotary Club in Kyiv in Ukraine after the fall of the Soviet Union. And I was working in Ukraine at that time as legal advisor in the Ukrainian parliament. So my father asked, hey, could you give us a hand in trying to set up this club, since I was on the ground? And so I did, and I was proud to be a charter member of that club when it was formed in 1992, and was also able to help my father organize a number of significant humanitarian projects to Ukraine through his club, through his district, and with the other sponsoring clubs. So it was really my father who brought Rotary to me, and I'm very, very glad that he did. He was also responsible for me finding out about the job of being a general secretary, but that's another story.
I want to talk a little bit more about your time in Eastern Europe in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. I understand that you moved to Moscow as a newlywed. How did that experience inform your perceptions of what's happening in Russia today?
I met my wife, Marga, who's from Argentina in Washington, and we were married in mid-December in Santa Fe, Argentina. And just prior to that, I had accepted a position to move to Moscow, the firm of Baker McKenzie, which was the first Western law firm that was accredited in the former Soviet Union, and it was still the Soviet Union. We shut down our operations in the United States. Everything we owned was in 17 boxes. We flew, I think it was on Pan Am, to Moscow, and then spent the next literally 3 years living both in Moscow and then in Ukraine in a hotel room. I like to say that Marga is probably the first, and I'm sure the last, Argentine to have taken her honeymoon in Moscow in early January. And it was an extraordinarily interesting time because it was perestroika. There was an opening. Obviously, our firm was able to open our office there, but it was still the Soviet Union. And so I was very glad that for at least 2 years, or almost 2 years, I was able to experience what it was like living and working in that Soviet system. It wasn't easy. There weren't very many restaurants at the time. For Marga, it was I really give her a tremendous amount of credit. It was not easy at all. We had to cook dinner on a hot plate. She washed the dishes in the bathtub. It was sort of, camping 101 in a Soviet hotel room. But it gave me a great appreciation for what life had been under the Soviet system. As a lawyer, it couldn't have been any more interesting, sort of blazing a trail, trying to operate Western legal principles in a country which was still, the legal system was still largely Soviet, and to play a part in really the evolution and development of the legal system there.
Andy Warhol is credited with saying that in the future, everyone will be world famous for 15 minutes. You've referenced your own 15 minutes of fame before. What's the story?
My 15 minutes came in August of 1991. As I had mentioned earlier, I had moved to Ukraine in the spring of 1991 from Moscow. And I had taken a leave of absence from the law firm I was working with, Baker & McKenzie, to work for a year as a legal advisor in the Ukrainian parliament funded by George Soros. And then, if you recall, the coup happened on August of 1991, and all these different communiques were being issued by the junta that had carried out the coup. I went immediately to the parliament building and spent the first 3 days of the coup outside of Leonid Kravchuk's office. He was the head of the parliament at the time, eventually became Ukraine's first president after independence, and really had an inside view in terms of what was happening at that time. Then 2 days later, 21st, if I'm not mistaken, Boris Yeltsin gets on the tank in front of the White House in Moscow. The coup's over. And so in Ukraine, the question then was, how is Ukraine going to react to the events that were occurring in Moscow? And the Ukrainian parliament was out of session, so they called parliament back for the 24th. The day before the parliament was supposed to meet, the democratic opposition, which had about 25% of the deputies in the Ukrainian parliament at the time, the other 75% were the communists, met to try to determine what they were going to do the next day. And a big debate broke out between two factions, one that said, let's go for independence tomorrow, and another said, we don't want to be independent in a country that's led by the communists, because an independent Ukraine would still be led by the communists. Let's first deal with the communist issue and then go for independence a little bit later. And for me, this is sort of like being in Philadelphia on July 3rd, 1776, and hearing Madison, Franklin, and Jefferson all talking about what they were going to try to do the next day. Well, as the evening went on, they eventually decided, let's go for independence tomorrow. And so they began drafting a whole series of decrees, de-communizing this, nationalizing Communist Party property, et cetera, et cetera. And they came up with more than a dozen decrees that they wanted to be voted on the next day. And as they're working on it, one of the deputies comes up to me and says, John, we have a problem. And I said, what is it? He said, we have no way of photocopying these decrees. And I said, well, just go to the secretariat. they have a copy machine, and they said, we can't go to the secretariat because the communists control the secretariat. They'll never let us photocopy these things. And I had, by chance, a small Canon PC7 copy machine, and Marga had just brought a box of A4 paper from Baker McKenzie's office in Moscow. And so I said, give me all these decrees. And with a student from the university, we sat up all night and made 450 copies of all these decrees. Now, we didn't have enough paper to do one page per decree, so we had to put four on a page. Next morning, I show up, I hand the box of these decrees to the deputy head of the opposition, to the Democratic faction. The communists freak out, where did all this come from? And 6 hours later, Ukraine declared independence. And for me to be in the gallery to see that happen was just incredible. But also to realize that perhaps that was my 15 minutes of fame, and that I'm sure Ukraine would have probably declared independence without that, but who knows? And I was glad to play a small part in that moment to help Ukraine take that historic step and become an independent country.
I hope you kept one of those 450 copies for yourself. John, after Ukraine gained independence, what other role, if any, did you play in further establishing the new country?
As you know, Ukraine became independent in August of 1991. And so after December then, Ukraine is now a country. And it then needed to embark on the journey of drafting new legislation and coming up with a new constitution. That year, I was still working in the parliament. And so I put together a group of Western constitutional experts from around the world. All this was being funded by George Soros. And I took this group to Prague in the spring of 1992. We locked ourselves in a conference room for, I think it was 3 or 4 days, and hammered out the initial draft of the Ukrainian constitution. I was there to sort of facilitate and help. I was a lawyer, but not a constitutional expert, but I was there to facilitate and help. And it was just great to see all these experts sitting around developing with their Ukrainian colleagues an initial draft of the Constitution. The Constitution, which was ultimately adopted several years later, was somewhat different. That version was viewed as the Prague version, and it was very, very progressive, probably too progressive for Ukraine at that time, coming out of that post-Soviet legacy. So ultimately, the Constitution, which was adopted several years later, was different. But this was the first crack at it. I have a copy of that signed by all the members of the Ukrainian Constitutional Committee. And it's a very nice memento for me to have. And again, to have a bird's eye view of the development of Ukraine as a country.
John Huko is the CEO of Evanston, Illinois-based Rotary International. He's been a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Huko has published papers and articles in leading U.S. and international publications, and he's spoken extensively about political and business issues dealing with the former Soviet Union, Central Europe, Africa, and Latin America. We turn now to Ukrainian author and public intellectual Andrei Kirkov. Kirkov is one of Ukraine's best-known novelists. He lived in Ukraine's capital city of Kyiv, but the day after Russia invaded his country on February 24th, Kirkov received a phone call from an old friend. That friend notified him that Kirkov was on the Kremlin's blacklist. That's because of his past criticism of Vladimir Putin. Kirkov's friend warned him that if Russian forces seized Kyiv, his safety could be jeopardized. Kirkov and his wife, an English expat, collected a few essentials and joined the millions of Ukrainians who have been forced to flee. In his latest book, Diary of an Invasion, Kirkov documents in vivid literary style how his life very painfully changed in the early days of the invasion. What impact are these most recent attacks having on the shape of the war and on the attitudes of Ukrainians that you're speaking with?
Well, I was actually in Kyiv under the drone attacks during the missile strikes. And every time we had a strike, we had no electricity, no running water, no heating, sometimes for several days afterwards. And this became an everyday reality in Ukraine. It doesn't make people depressed. I mean, probably somebody is depressed, but usually it makes people angry, more angry. And actually, I mean, even in the New Year Eve, at midnight, Russia was shelling Ukraine with Iranian drones. I'm very happy that all the drones were shut down by the anti-air raid, the missiles. But people are defiant. People are defiant. And actually, on the 31st of December, all the theater performances and concert halls were full.
So you're talking about the impact of these drone attacks and missile strikes as strengthening Ukrainian resolve, strengthening the defiance of the people in the face of those attacks. What impact, however, is the devastation on the infrastructure having just on daily life as it plays out for Ukrainians as they try to go about the business of staying safe and living their lives?
Well, I mean, people are used to spend hours in corridors and in the bomb shelters. And we spent half of the night on the 1st of January in our corridor. So, I mean, nobody complains. People are trying to adapt, even adapt their businesses to this new reality. So the hottest thing to buy now in Ukraine is an electric generator. And you have generators on the street outside of pharmacies and cafes and restaurants. So, I mean, this is the reality. What is interesting that actually the refugees, Ukrainian refugees who are abroad, they are, I think, much more affected by the new strikes against Ukrainian cities because, I mean, they are afraid for their loved ones who remained in Ukraine. And those who remain in Ukraine, they are almost used to this reality. I mean, some people are becoming a bit more fatalistic. I mean, some people are tired to run to the bomb shelters, but others became much more disciplined.
John, we hear Andrei talking about the reactions within the country, the impact on daily life, and then also that comparison to how Ukrainians are feeling who are living outside of Ukraine right now. What's been your reaction to watching this play out from afar?
Well, first, probably similar to what most people are feeling in the civilized world, just horror to see this incredible destruction and terror that completely unprovoked that Putin has unleashed against Ukraine. You know, Andrei mentioned the kind of the devastation and the daily struggles that Ukrainians are going through. But I do think there is, in somewhat paradoxically, a silver lining for Ukraine in all of this. This has really, in my view, been sort of the penultimate step in creating a truly unified Ukrainian nation. As Andrei mentioned, the pride in being Ukrainian, the growth in the use of the Ukrainian language in all parts of Ukraine, not just in, you know, Western Ukraine, Central Ukraine, and in Eastern Ukraine as well. And it's really, it's, you know, in some ways, everything has backfired on Putin. If his goal was to sort of bring Ukraine to heel, the exact opposite had happened. If his goal was to destroy Ukrainian culture and language and national identity, the exact opposite has happened. And from the perspective of someone who grew up in the West and who had to spend most of my life explaining to people that Ukraine is not Russia, that the Soviet Union is not synonymous with Russia, point out where Ukraine even is on the map, the whole world now knows about Ukraine. Zelensky has now become probably one of the most best-known figures in the world today, period. So I think from my perspective, as terrible as this war has been, the enormous human suffering that it has caused, it has really accelerated and jolted forward the creation of a unified Ukrainian nation. A lot of challenges still ahead of Ukraine, and we can get into that a little bit later if you'd like, Steve. But I think it's heartwarming in a sense to see that now I don't ever have to explain to anyone, where is Ukraine? What is Ukraine? And it's put Ukraine on the map, and the ingenuity of the Ukrainians and their fortitude and their resilience has really been admirable to watch.
Andrei, I want to come to you to pick up on the point that John was just making as it relates to the sense of Ukrainian identity and the sense of the relationship between Russian identity and Ukrainian identity. You were born in what is now St. Petersburg, what was then Leningrad, grew up in Kyiv, but your native language is Russian. You've spent your career, most of your career, writing in Russian. So how do you think about that interplay and this sense of connection to Russian identity and Ukrainian identity now?
Thank you. It's quite a tricky question, but I will try to answer it. Because, I mean, not many people in the world understand the difference between Russian and Ukrainian mentality. Ukrainians were always individualists, and Russians were always collective people. They were monarchists. I mean, they needed a tsar to love or to kill and then to love the next tsar. In Ukraine, there is a tradition, old tradition, to have no respect for political power. And so every Ukrainian has his own opinion about everything. And every Ukrainian has in his head his own image of ideal Ukraine, where he would like to live. All Russians have the same image of great Russia. So this is the main difference. And if I speak Moldovan or Russian, or even I speak Armenian, but I live in Ukraine and I'm citizen of Ukraine, I have Ukrainian mentality. I want my opinion to be heard and respected, and I'm anti-collective. And actually, I want also to state that the first victims of this war were Russian speakers in Ukraine, although Putin said that he is coming with the army to save Russian speakers from Ukrainian nationals. But most of Russian speakers in Ukraine are Ukrainian patriots and are pro-European individualists who don't want to have anything to do with collective Russia, with collective Putin. And so, I mean, I studied Ukrainian when I was 14, still in the Soviet school. And I worked as an editor in Ukrainian state publishing house. I was editing translations from foreign languages into Ukrainian. So, I mean, my love and my respect for Ukrainian language doesn't clash with my Russian origin. So, I mean, the question of my origin doesn't also show that I have Russian cultural background. So actually, my Russian language is not a marker of my political attitude or my cultural affiliation.
It's fascinating to hear you talk about how your own personal history and the way in which culture and language play out in terms of a Ukrainian identity. Is there an anecdote from your latest book, Diary of an Invasion, that speaks to that sense of resolve or spirit or strengthening of society?
Well, in this book, there are lots of stories which happened to me, to my family, and to my friends. And actually, in the very beginning of the war, on 27th, I think, of February, we were stuck in the Carpathian Mountains in the car because, I mean, I was in the beginning of the war with my wife in Kyiv. My three kids with their friends were in Lviv. And on the second day of the war, we started with the car going to Lviv to pick them up. And it took 22 hours to get to Lviv. But then we wanted to go to the Hungarian border, to Transcarpathia. And when we stuck in Carpathian Mountains, in the traffic jam that was 50 miles long, and it was 1 o'clock in the morning, minus 10 Celsius. So, I mean, you don't have enough petrol. If you run petrol to keep warm, you will not have petrol to get further. And suddenly, actually, you understand that everybody is prepared to help everybody else. And I found a man, I got a phone number of a man who lived in a village not far away from the place where we were stuck. And I found out that he bought a Soviet-built hostel, which was half-ruined somewhere in another village, but not far away. So I called him and asked if it is possible to stay a night in his place. And he came to pick us and to show us the way to this hostel. And then he returned to the traffic jam, and he brought to this hostel 20 more cars with families. And so, I mean, like 50 people suddenly had almost for free possibility to sleep the night, because many people who were driving cars, they were driving from Dnipro, from Kharkiv for 3 for 4 days without rest. And I mean, this kind of openness and readiness to help, it was on every step. I mean, 1 week later, an old lady, retired lady, who never met us, but she is a relative of somebody who knows me. She gave us the key from her flat, and she moved in with her daughter and daughter's family. So we stayed in her flat for several months afterwards.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It's an example, I think, of the kinds of stories that have really captivated the world, the sources of inspiration and resilience. John, to come back to you for a second, though, you said a minute ago that the way this war has played out has backfired on Putin, that Putin's goal was to, in many respects, reconstitute the Soviet Union and to bring Ukraine firmly and directly under Russian control and to push away the prospects of deeper ties with the West, most notably ties to the EU and to NATO. If a Western-aligned Ukraine is an existential threat to Russia from Putin's point of view, does this mean that he doubles down even more on everything that he has already started with the invasion a year ago?
Yeah, I think Putin, in a way, has really backed himself into a corner, because I think his very regime now is at stake. He has to lose the war, and I think he will lose this war. I think you're going to see, you know, tremendous turmoil and chaos within Russia. As Andrei very well knows, Russia itself is a confederation. It's the Russian Federation. It's a multi-ethnic state with a lot of internal tensions kind of built into it. So I think Putin's kind of walked out on the ledge. He's jumped off the cliff, and he's hoping his parachute will open. But I did want to pick up on an earlier point that Andrei made in terms of the growth of Ukraine as a nation, as a people. And as sort of we look back over the last 30 years, as you know, we had the independence in 91, where the overwhelming majority of Ukrainians in the referendum of December of 91 voted for independence, including Crimea, slightly above 50%. Over the last 30 years, we've seen that consolidation of Ukraine, independence, then, as Andrei mentioned, the Orange Revolution in 2004, Maidan in 13-14, and now you have this war, further led to that consolidation. But I do think there is one, and I'd be interested in getting Andrei's take on this, there's one additional step that I think Ukraine needs to take after they win this war to really consolidate not only nationhood, but to truly become a Western country, for lack of a better word. And that is that even prior to the war, the systemic issues of corruption, lack of rule of law, all of that was still there. Ukraine hadn't quite tackled that fully, gotten much better from the days of Kuchma and all of that. But there were still some significant underlying issues, oligarchs running the economy, et cetera, et cetera. I would suggest that when the war ends and these billions and billions of dollars of reconstruction money will be coming into Ukraine, that we really use that as leverage to really try to force through and get at working with the Ukrainians to put in place these really fundamental changes that need to happen for Ukraine to truly take that final, in my view, last step of consolidating itself as a Western, for lack of a better word, a country. And here I think is where EU accession is extremely important, because that will become an additional stimulus for Ukraine to undertake these much needed reforms. But very interesting to hear your take, Andrei, on the sort of post-war Ukraine, because that in some ways is as important as winning this war.
Well, I mean, if we are talking about post-war, I mean, I would first start with the pre-escalation, pre-February situation in Ukraine, because at that time we got the civil society, which turned out to be much stronger and more effective than political elite. And then, I mean, Ukraine is a young country, and actually this is the young part of the generation of Ukrainians who went as volunteers at once on the 24th of February to the front lines. So I mean, I'm very hopeful, and I'm quite happy with the anti-oligarch law that was signed before the escalation by Zelensky. You don't feel presence of oligarchs now in politics. It doesn't mean that they don't exist. They can come back. They can buy their ways back. But I hope actually it won't happen, because, I mean, people are used now not to see the presence of oligarchs.
John, from your perspective, President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Washington at the end of 2021, speaking to a joint session of Congress. He's been meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron, Indian Prime Minister Modi. He's released a 10-point plan for peace that was rejected by Vladimir Putin immediately. But what are your thoughts on the efforts toward peace versus what you were saying before? And are they at conflict necessarily with one another?
Well, I think, you know, I think there's zero chance that politically that Zelensky or any Ukrainian leader at this point can talk about territorial concessions, right? I mean, the society is overwhelmingly in favor of winning this war. The question is, what do we mean by victory? And is it back to the borders that were there from February 23rd, or is it going all the way back to pre-Maidan, let's say? And, you know, I suspect within Ukraine, there's going to be a sort of a huge debate over, you know, what the definition of victory is. But regardless of which of those two scenarios one looks at, Ukraine needs to, at least in my view, push Russia back to the February 23rd border. And this is where Western support is absolutely critical, that Western unity needs to be maintained. I don't know, Andrei, you know, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is not going to invade Moscow. Ukraine is not actually trying to get Russian territories. Ukraine wants its territories back. And of course, after this, potentially negotiations are possible, but obviously not with Putin, who will not agree to any kind of negotiations, leading actually to his political defeat in his own country.
So, Andrei, if I hear you right, you're essentially saying that there can be no permanent peace with Putin in power in Russia. Is that the bottom line?
Well, I hope that actually the lack of advances of Russian army will create internal pressure in the military circles in Moscow. And there will be probably more and more opposition to Putin, maybe not vocal, but there will be some kind of sabotage, quiet sabotage or quiet disagreement, which would lead to not fulfilling Putin's orders, because he will be probably taken as a less and less adequate politician by his own political elite, because, I mean, they are younger than him, they are maybe healthier than him, they might survive him physically, but then they understand that they will keep responsibility for these war crimes. I mean, whoever lives longer, it doesn't mean that he will live happier.
John, what's your thought about what the future holds in the near term?
Well, I think for me, it's about continued Western support. Obviously, without Western support, Ukraine has no chance of winning this war. And some of the things that Andrei just talked about are very real. But for me, it comes down to maintaining Western unity to support Ukraine, because that's really the key. The Ukrainians themselves, they're going to fight to the end. Morale is extremely high. All of Ukraine is united.
I agree 100%, 200%.
As we near the 1 year anniversary of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, we do so entering the depths of winter. We do so with the impact on Ukrainian infrastructure, not to mention the loss of lives that this war has inflicted on thousands of people in both countries. So, John, from your perspective, what are the biggest and most pressing humanitarian needs right now, and how is Rotary playing a role in that?
Well, you know, earlier in the interview, Andrei mentioned the importance of civil society in Ukraine. And certainly, if you compare civil society in Russia, which is basically non-existent now, to society in Ukraine, it's like night and day. And that's one of the hallmarks of Ukraine. Civil society is today playing an extremely important role in dealing with some of the humanitarian catastrophes that are happening. And they're going to play a huge role, as Andrei mentioned earlier as well, post-war, in terms of holding politicians' feet to the fire, demanding reform, demanding that corruption be rooted out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So with respect to the war, I'm extraordinarily proud of Rotary. Shortly after the war started, we put together a Ukrainian disaster relief fund in our Rotary Foundation. Within a matter of weeks, we raised $15 million from Rotarians around the world, an outpouring of support we haven't seen ever, I think, in our history for a single cause. And our Rotarians in Ukraine, we have about 1,200 Rotarians in Ukraine, 60-some clubs, sprang into action and have made a tremendous difference in their various communities. And I think if there's ever an example of the impact Rotary is having, is that our membership has actually increased in Ukraine since the start of the war. And our Ukrainians, Rotarians, many of whom have lost their homes, have had to flee, have lost their businesses, continue to work to help Ukraine. And so we've provided ambulances, fire trucks, medical equipment, you name it, shelter, food. And it's not just the Rotarians in Ukraine, in the neighboring countries, Baltics, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, Romania, Moldova, extraordinary outpouring of support for the Ukrainian refugees and throughout Europe, the United States as well. And that's just the $15 million we received in the Rotary Foundation. There's also, we're hearing anecdotally, of tremendous amounts of in-kind and cash contributions going directly from Rotary clubs and districts to Ukraine. So I would suspect we've probably provided somewhere between $30 to $40 million worth of relief aid to Ukraine since the war started. And not just Rotary. I mean, there's been literally hundreds and hundreds of nonprofits, both Ukrainian-based and outside the country, that have stepped up and are helping Ukraine. And I think it just shows the power of civil society and the importance that civil society has in societies, not only in terms of driving change within society, but in stepping up and fulfilling needs at a time when government structures are in trouble and getting destroyed and bombed, et cetera.
Well, you also, Andrei, described yourself as a pathological optimist in an article that was in the New Yorker magazine. So does that still hold, I take it?
Yeah, but I hope I don't sound pathological when I'm talking about the future.
Andrei Kurkov is the author of more than 20 books, including the best-selling novel Death and the Penguin. His work has been translated into over 30 languages and published in more than 60 countries. You can read his latest book, Diary of an Invasion, a documentation of Kurkov's life in the early days of the war in Ukraine. Boris Bodnar is a businessman and member of the Rotary Club of Ukraine Unity Passport. He was born and raised in the United Kingdom, where his parents settled after fleeing Ukraine during World War II. Bodnar moved to Lviv 5 years ago after spending much of his life and career in the UK. When the war began, Bodnar and his fellow Rotary members in Ukraine formed a crisis committee to assist refugees who were fleeing cities under attack. The goal was to bring in supplies donated by Rotary clubs around the world and distribute them to the areas of greatest need. The war disrupted Bodnar's business, and Rotary soon became his 24/7 job. Boris, thanks so much for talking with us. You are currently living in Lviv, and we're curious, perhaps you could tell us just a little bit more about the city that you now call home. How would you characterize it?
Lviv is a beautiful city. It's not beautiful in a sense that it's, you know, it's perfect in every way. It's rather shabby in a lot of ways, but it has a lot of beautiful architecture. It has a lot of very ugly architecture, but it has an ambiance to it that really draws you in. It's friendly. There is a huge cafe culture, you know, based on the fact that Lviv is probably the coffee capital of Europe. There's always something amazing going on. There's an amazing jazz festival that happens in Lviv every year. You know, when one thing stops, then there's something else. There's great street life in the center of town. And it's a really buzzing place, a very safe place.
How has your life changed since the invasion? What impact has it had on not only the city in which you reside, but the rhythm of your day and the way in which you are engaging the world?
It became very clear very early on where the invasion was biting the most. Lots of infrastructure problems were occurring, and one of those was access to clean drinking water, where water supply infrastructure had been damaged or destroyed. People were finding themselves in very difficult situations with no access to, you know, running water. And, as somebody said to me very early on, you can live without gas, electricity, but if you don't have water to drink, then you just die. A friend of ours, who is now a member of my club from southeast of England, came over and brought me a packet of water purification tablets and said, look, I don't know what the situation is like in Lviv, but, you know, just in case you need something to help you have drinking water, then here's something for you. And within about a month, we were bringing over hundreds of thousands of these tablets and distributing them all around the country. And I just before this call, I had a call with a Rotary charitable company in England called Aquabox, that have been supplying us with small-scale filters that can help families or smaller groups of people, or even community filters that are really useful for hospitals and larger communities. And that continues.
What are the biggest needs facing Ukrainians now, in addition to water?
Keeping warm. One of the things that we've also initiated and we're doing now, there's a lorry coming over from England carrying around about £20,000 worth of thermal underwear. For example, that's very important. The difficulties with the electricity infrastructure means that, you know, we have periodic power cuts, scheduled power cuts, which, you know, can be very difficult in some circumstances. You know, personal circumstances, it's difficult to live without power, but also in, you know, social environments, in medical centers. So backup generators are very important. We have a Rotary project in a village called Moshtun near Kyiv, which was, you know, destroyed to the extent of something like 70-80%. Rotary, together with local organizations, are erecting temporary housing. They were designed with heating that's electricity-based, which means that it's a bit of a problem. What we're trying to do now is bring in as many generators as possible so that each unit can have its own generator to make sure that people can live in these temporary units and be warm during the winter.
You know, Boris, we have many people, many Rotarians, in fact, listening to this podcast now. So what would you like to say to them, and what can they do to assist in this effort to help the people of Ukraine?
Well, the most important thing is communication and engagement. We're available 24/7 to understand what it is that people want to do. We work on a premise that everybody has a desire to help, but not everybody really knows what to do. As I often say to people, I can help you to help us if I can understand what it is that you're able to do or that you want to do. What are your resources? And how can we potentially combine your resources with resources of your local other clubs or your district, or not just your district, as I mentioned earlier. How can we connect, a district in California, for example, with a district in Germany, where we have a very strong relationship now, and we meet every week, and they've provided so many supplies. They've funded a number of ambulances. They've done fundraising in the US that they've transferred to Germany, and they've therefore been able to provide supplies down to Mykolaiv, which has, you know, been suffering very heavily. So it's about engagement and communication.
You moved from the UK to Ukraine just before the COVID pandemic broke out. And then in 2021, Russia invaded your country. Do you ever regret making that move?
No. I don't feel guilty for it either. I mean, it's Look, the point is that sometimes you strongly believe in things and you make a point of it, or sometimes it's just there. I mean, there is a reason why I'm here, which isn't about me planning to be here. When I came here in 1990, I realized the dream that I'd had growing up as a young person in England, in the Ukrainian community, to Ukrainian parents who'd had families who'd suffered at the hands of both or various people who had occupied Ukraine in the past. Being here, knowing what I know now and being active in what I'm doing now, I realized that there is a reason why I'm here. And I have absolutely no regrets. And where at the beginning of the war, I had so many calls from people, friends from various countries saying, look, you know, you should get out, come and stay with us, whatever. It's not even a question for me.
Well, Boris, we wish you all the best for safety and success in your efforts and all the humanitarian relief that you are leading in Ukraine. We thank you so much for this conversation as well and hope we can chat again soon.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
Special thanks again to our guests, John Huko, Andrei Kirkov, and Boris Bodno. You can offer support for Ukrainians through Rotary's district and global grants or by contacting affected districts. District 2232 formed a committee to help people affected by the war and identified urgently needed medical supplies to help injured civilians. This episode of the Rotary Magazine podcast is produced by Kristen Morris and edited by Johanna Zorn and Wen Wong, with production by Mike Novak. Audio production assistance was provided by Alex Irakanen. I'm Steve Edwards. Thanks for listening.